Hey, everybody. Welcome to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday, and we've got a great interview lined up for you today. Now, I want to make a mention. You'll get the entire interview. The only segment of today's show you won't hear is our Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. Why? Because that's under Stitcher Premium. We want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to hear these remarkable interviews of these incredible true crime stories. But for only $5 a month, you can subscribe to Stitcher Premium. That'll give you the entire episode. That includes the entire interview you're about to hear, plus Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, and every episode of Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal podcasting. All 1,000-plus episodes commercial-free. And if that's still not enough reason for you to want to subscribe, you don't just get True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio, which, let's face it, for $5 a month, that's pretty valuable. You get every other show underneath the Stitcher umbrella. That means hundreds of thousands of hours of your favorite type of podcast programming commercial-free. Nobody got time for commercials. So if you're interested, then make sure you go subscribe now to Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, Darkness Radio, for some deep discounts for an entire year's savings. Go do that right now. Take advantage of the special and be able to listen to Darkness Radio, True Crime Tuesday, and all of the other amazing programs across Stitcher's platform. Go subscribe right now. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of True Crime Tuesday. Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
We've got a sequel of sorts today. We had our guest on last year, April, I believe, of 2020, to discuss her book, First Degree Rage, the true story of the assassin and obsession and murder. And she has her second book out in the series, Raging On, the Rage True Crime series. We are back with Detective Paula May to discuss this case as it continues to evolve for her. Thank you so much for coming back with us, Detective May.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So for our listeners, again, this episode appeared last April of 2020. So you can find it in the archives. But to catch listeners up and for newer listeners that would like to jump in feet first, can you give us a synopsis of the first book? And I remember the chilling quote you had from that book. There was no brown in his eyes at all. They were just two black buttons. I looked in his eyes. All I saw was solid black against the whites. It wasn't natural. It was creepy, unnerving, demonic. This story was really chilling. I remember getting so many different emails from people listening to this tale and this true crime story unfold. So if you could set the stage for us again on where we started in the first book, and then we'll launch into where the story continues.
Sure. Well, I definitely remember looking into his eyes and he being Elsie Underwood, who happened to be a police officer in my home state of North Carolina, where I worked. And that case began on a very cold, wintry day off of the Blue Ridge Parkway, where we found a body of a nude man who was blanketed by snow. And he had been shot and killed, shot twice in the head. And so we spent our initial hours getting him identified, and we discovered that he had been living in the town of Salisbury, North Carolina, so the home of Elsie Underwood. And so as the case progressed and we were able to identify the body, we found several interesting things about the body. He had actually been arrested for assassinating the Prime Minister, Olof Palme, of Sweden in 1986, but was later released when he could not be selected out of a lineup. And he sued the Swedish government for false arrest, and he came to the United States seeking political asylum and wound up after meeting some friends in Salisbury. Well, he met a really sweet lady who was a high school English teacher, and her name was Kay. Well, Kay was the ex-fiancée of this police officer. And Kay had also suffered the murder of her mother in December of 93, just before we found this body in the woods in January of 94. And so first-degree rage is the story of the almost four-year investigation. And I was the lead detective in the case. I was working then with the Watauga County Sheriff's Office. And the case lasted so long because we had very little in the way of physical evidence. We did develop Underwood as a suspect early on. And so first-degree rage is the story of what happened to Kay as she found herself threatened and her property vandalized, her son's life threatened, and just stalked and terrorized during Underwood's reign of terror. So first-degree rage ended with his trial after some pretty amazing things happened in the way of developing our physical evidence, or at least analyzing the physical evidence that was found. Like I said, there was very little of it. And so it was also happened to be the first case in North Carolina that mitochondrial DNA analysis was introduced. So it's got a lot of really intriguing forensic elements in the case as well. But first degree rage ended with his trial. And he was subsequently convicted. It was a capital trial, but the jury was 11-1 for the death penalty. And so because it was not unanimous, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder and also another 40 years in prison on top of that for first-degree kidnapping. And so that is where first-degree rage ended. But he was never charged with the murder of Catherine Miller, Kay's sweet little mother, whom he brutally murdered in her home. And so,
well, let me ask you, reeling back to the comment about his eyes, and just was this something that, as you talked to him, his eyes appeared to get darker? Did he just seem to have this overwhelming presence of evil around him, or was this more of just in the moment, you know, this is always how he looks, but it just looked even more terrifying than usual?
He did always have very dark eyes, but once it was just one-on-one and the rage inside him was seeping out, his eyes did get darker, so that the dark brown in his eyes evaporated into just blackness, and the evil that was present became very real in those moments. I know Kay described something very similar at times when he just seemed to lose control on the inside, and he would not agree to be questioned by anyone else in the case, but he did ask to talk to me. So it was, so he and I were alone for some time, in a jail cell. Just, he had requested that I come. He wanted to talk, said he was willing to talk, but he only wanted to talk to me. Now, ultimately, he was only trying to manipulate me and play games. He did have 19 and a half years of law enforcement experience, so he knew how the system worked. But when his efforts to manipulate me failed in that environment, that's when the rage became apparent. And even though he struggled to maintain his demeanor externally, it was very obvious that something was really wrong with him, that there was an evil presence there. And even the whole atmosphere, even the temperature of the room seemed to change.
That's really terrifying that you're in the presence of something, someone so dark that it actually affects the surroundings. You know, doing a paranormal show for 15, 16 years here, to hear something like that, it almost sounds like a case of possession.
Well, he definitely was demonically influenced, if not possessed. In my 32 years of law enforcement, there have been just a very few people I have encountered like that. But he definitely was one of them. And I have a very strong spiritual background and very committed to my religious belief. And so I think if I had not been, the whole experience would have been even more terrifying than it was. I seem to have a sense of calmness and peace that came over me, allowed me to talk with him, but it was very obvious that he was not in control, at least not the person that he once was. I think if you remember in the book, there's quite a bit of history as he grew up and how he was physically and emotionally abused. And whatever person he was at a young age was not the person that I interacted with during that case.
When you see something like that, you encounter something that seems almost otherworldly. How does that affect and impact the way you investigate a case and deal with that person?
Well, I think that depends on the investigator. For me, it's a spiritual battle, first and foremost. Of course, we have various interview and interrogation techniques that we use as investigators. But the typical tactics are not going to work when you're trying to communicate with someone like that. And it was readily apparent, even from the beginning, that he was not going to give me anything as far as he certainly was not going to confess. He was not going to give me anything that he thought that I would be able to use against him in any way. He was more seeking to know what the evidence was against him, and I guess he thought he could get all of that information from me at that point. But as far as interviewing him, like I said, the peace of God just came over me, and there's so much divine intervention in that case anyway. It's mind-boggling. Just when we would be about to give up, something would just, fall into our laps. But dealing with L.C. Underwood was a whole different, set of rules seemed to apply from just, your typical interrogation with someone who has gotten themselves into trouble. No tactics would work as far as when you're dealing with a man who doesn't have a conscience, and I believe he was a psychopath. He has no conscience. He has no moral compass. He has nothing to, no kind of frame of reference that you can attach or, begin at in order to prick his conscience or to, appeal to him in some way that he would want to become cooperative. There just was nothing there. And I realized very quickly that one conversation, an attempt to interrogate him, was just an effort in futility.
Is it a whole different set of circumstances when you're dealing with somebody in law enforcement? Or do you just have to treat every perpetrator like you would any other perpetrator?
Well, in the ways as far as treating people with dignity and respect, even no matter what they've done, that doesn't change no matter what their occupation is. But when you are dealing with someone in law enforcement, it's almost like dealing with someone who's been in prison, in and out of prison most of their lives. They know the system. They know the drill. They know what you're trying to do. They know the information that you want to obtain. They also know the consequences of every statement that they give or of their conduct. They know the practical and realistic consequences. If you're dealing with a first-time offender, they have an element of the fear of the unknown. They don't know if they're going to go to prison, or they don't know how long they will go to prison. They don't know the financial consequences. So you can work with someone and explaining those things, and you have some options. But if you're dealing with a repeat offender, your options become more limited. And if you're dealing with someone that's experienced in law enforcement, they know what's more than likely going to happen. They know where you're coming from. And they also know, in general, to keep their mouths shut as far as, you know, statements right. that would further incriminate them. I don't like to use trickery and that kind of thing when interrogating someone. And we don't make promises on behalf of sentencing and that kind of thing. But, you know, we are in a position that we can, you know, go to bat for someone that is cooperative and make sure that the prosecution and the judge and the courts know that this person has been cooperative. They've demonstrated remorse. They're interested in finding a way to make things right, as opposed to someone like Elsie Underwood that just absolutely could not put himself in anyone else's shoes, has no sympathy, no empathy, no remorse whatsoever.
A complete sociopath, huh?
Yes, in my opinion, he definitely was. Even when we were talking about the murder of Catherine Miller, and she was just a sweet little grandmotherly type, 77 years old when she was murdered in her home. She had a little pan of beans on the stove and had gotten the newspaper in and was reading the newspaper. And she had worked at least 40 hours a week in an accounting department of a refrigeration firm. And she had worked for over 40 years and had rarely, if ever, missed a day of work. I mean, she was active in her church and her community. She was good to her neighbors. She was not anyone's enemy. But Underwood perceived her as his enemy because she was advising her only daughter, Kay, against remaining in a relationship with him, because she was very wise, I'm sure, and astute, and realized that he was bad news, and he definitely was no good for her daughter or her grandson. And so Elsie Underwood was aware of that. He also was aware of how emotionally dependent that Kay was on her mother, how close they were. Kay had lost her father and then had gotten close to a stepfather, and he also had passed away. And so the family really consisted there in Salisbury of just Catherine Miller, her daughter Kay, and Kay's son Jason. So going back to Elsie Underwood's childhood, he was abandoned by both of his parents. He was dumped off on an uncle who did not want him and took the opportunity to physically and emotionally abuse him. And when they didn't want to deal with anymore, they took him to an orphanage, and he grew up in a children's home in Winston-Salem. And then the day he turned 18, of course, he had to leave. But he because of his abandonment issues that were pervasive throughout all of his adult life, he could not stand the thought of Kay being so close to her mother, first of all, and secondly, her mother being so adamant that Kay needed to be away from him.
Now, you've got this set of crimes, right? This guy obviously is a bad guy. He's a dirtbag, and he targets people he thinks are going to hurt him, bring him down, cause problems like this. So yeah. With his background, with his past, why was he not considered a viable suspect in this case from the get-go?
Well, he pretty quickly rose to the surface as a suspect. He definitely was a subject in both the Catherine Miller homicide and the Vic Anderson homicide. Now, the Catherine Miller homicide took place another jurisdiction, and they had been working that homicide since early December. And then again, we didn't find Gunnarsson's body in the mountains where I lived and worked until January. So they had a good 3 weeks advance on the investigation. So once we were able to identify the body of Victor Gunnarsson, then we quickly learned that he had been reported missing in December. And he actually had been missing even before he was reported missing, because Kay was seeing him and they had made plans and so forth, and he just disappeared. Then her mother gets murdered, and actually from the time that Gunnarsson actually was missing until Catherine Miller's murder was only like 5 days. So even though they had a little almost a month ahead of us on the investigation, the actual homicides both took place within a very close period of time. So they once Victor Gunnarsson is reported missing, they have a missing persons case, and K becomes the common denominator as they start to interview people and things unfold. But K thought initially that maybe Gunnarsson just was no longer interested in her and was kind of blowing her off, because that was just a few days before her mother was murdered. Then when her mother was murdered, her world turned upside down, and she's dealing with that, and they're having the funeral and the burial, and she's dealing with her son. And so it's just a few days after that it dawns on her she still has not heard from Victor Gunnarsson. And so when he's reported missing and investigators start talking with her more, it occurs to her in a very alarming way, when it dawns on her, what if the person who killed her mother did something to Victor Gunnarsson and he did not just voluntarily leave? So she's thinking those things. They're becoming unwound, so to speak, and visible to the investigators there. Then we call and we find out we've got Victor Gunnarsson's body, and they know he did not leave at that point voluntarily. So we team up as an investigative team at that point. Don Gale was an SBI agent assigned to the Miller case with Rowan County Sheriff's Detective Terry Agner, and then Steve Wilson with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation in Boone was assigned to assist me with a homicide that we were investigating of Gunnarsson. So the four of us very quickly became a team, and Underwood rose to the top of the list as a suspect as we compiled our interviews together that we had conducted at that point, and just started, the facts started revealing themselves.
However, you're seeing the pieces fall into place here. How much, right. I'm just curious from the outside and for our listeners and myself, obviously all we know of real police work that, you know, the people that are not involved in law enforcement is off of what we know from TV. When you're doing this, did you go in with a pretty clear idea that he might have been involved in more, or did it take a while for these pieces to start to fall in place? Meaning, I guess, did you go mm-hmm. in with a preconceived notion and then find the evidence that seemed to back that up, or did the evidence just start to reveal the picture to you slowly?
Well, at the same time that we had identified Victor Gunnarsson and found out about Catherine Miller's murder, I am still dealing with calls from the Swedish National Police, from Interpol, from anybody in Sweden or anywhere else that's even remotely tied to the investigation of the assassination of the prime minister, because even to this date, that remains officially unsolved. So I did not know if this police officer from Salisbury, North Carolina, had killed Victor Gunnarsson, or if, you know, someone on behalf of the prime minister or associated with them in some way had come to the United States and found Victor Gunnarsson and murdered him because they believed that he had assassinated Prime Minister Olof Palme. So there's a lot of international intrigue all of a sudden that I'm dealing with, in addition to what's going on with this fellow law enforcement officer. And so it was real important to me, and also to Agent Wilson, that we remain objective. And just because something looks a certain way doesn't mean, you know, that's how it's going to be. So we really had to strive to remain open to all of the possibilities, because it could have been any number of things. And but as the investigation progressed over months, then pieces just kept coming together and everything just kept pointing to Underwood. The circumstances of the case, like I said, we didn't have much physical evidence, but the circumstantial evidence was really overwhelming, and we had already caught him in so many lies, directly or indirectly. And the weapons, his weapons were missing. We conducted a search. We searched his house and his vehicles and his property, and we had multiple searches. But the weapons that were the same make and model as the ones that fired the rounds that killed both Victor Gunderson and Catherine Miller, all of a sudden they had disappeared, and he could not or would not. And so it was a long investigation.
You know, obviously here you have a guy who refuses to yield, does not want to own up to any of the negativity that he's done to any of this. And there's no empathy, no remorse, no sympathy for any of the situation. What's it like to erode a character like that to get somewhere in a case like this? I mean, on the outside, I'm sure it looks circumstantial, but, you know, logically, all of the pieces, again, are falling into place beautifully. You've got just too much lined up to say this is not, you know, just really weird coincidence.
Right. Well, as we continue to investigate, things continued to occur with Underwood, the center of them. A new lady that he had began to date, when we met and talked with her, and Underwood found out about it because he had told her a bunch of lies, and he had told her very little about being the subject of two homicides, and what he did tell her was made it sound like that, of course, we're the bad police and we're out to get him and set him up, you know, this man that I had never even heard of before. And so when she began to realize that he was not being truthful with her, and things just did not seem right with him as she continued in that relationship, he actually attempted to kill her. He attempted to blow her up in an explosion in her apartment. She was a smoker and had gas. He had turned the gas appliances on in her apartment and actually had tried to kill her. So things are continuing to happen. Kay is continuing to be harassed, although more subtly at this point. And so we feel like that there are people in danger as long as he is out there. So there were times when we would go to the district attorney and we said, we realize we just have a lot of circumstantial evidence. We really believe it's enough for a jury to convict, and we're concerned about him being dangerous and people being in danger while he's not in custody, having not been arrested. But the prosecutor, he was a very wise man, and he was very well experienced, and he would just reiterate to us, we only have one shot at this. We cannot afford, you know, to lose it. Let's just make sure that we've exhausted every possible avenue of finding evidence against him. And because of his patience and our perseverance, ultimately that did come to fruition. With the mitochondrial DNA, which was some head hair evidence that was found, that was the most significant. There were other pieces of physical evidence as well, but that was the most significant. But that was not until we had investigated a couple of years to even get to that point.
So I need to know then, and I know, Paula, when you're an investigator focusing on a case, you have to focus on that case. You have to take that and not start getting distracted by other angles.
Right.
But with this guy, obviously he's done this and he's done this before.
Right.
Do you believe that two or three murders is the end and, you know, beginning and end of his entire career as a killer? Or do you believe that there are other gravestones in his backyard?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. There was some question at some point about possibly some prostitutions, murders that were unsolved, but nothing that would clearly link him to those. I do think it's possible because of his mentality, but his mental issues were getting drastically worse over time. And I think what set him off at the point right before that he murdered Catherine Miller, that Catherine Miller was murdered and Victor Gunnarsson was kidnapped and murdered, was he had been stalking Kay ever since she had tried to end their relationship. And at one point they were even engaged. And so he was continuing to stalk her, even though she was like, you know, I just want to be friends, you know, just trying to get him away from her. And, but at that point he had gotten caught stalking her. In fact, he caused a scene in a restaurant when Kay was out with a male friend. And, he had gone into the restaurant, made a scene, dumped tea in her lap, and just mortified her. You know, she humiliated her in the restaurant. And so he got suspended over that little stunt. And so he was on suspension from the police department when the murders occurred just a few days later. So I think the only thing that had been constant in his adult life had been his law enforcement career. And it was very problematic. And he is very fortunate, so to speak, that he did not lose it earlier. But he would go from department to department, and he would get involved perhaps with in a dating relationship or a marital relationship. And when those women realized that he was not what he seemed, and they tried to end the relationships with them, he became very violent, very abusive, very assaultive, and just went to lengths to embarrass them with things like painting obscenities about them on their church, on like the outside of the church wall, their homes, their cars. I mean, just, and incidentally, that was always in red spray paint. And one of the last acts of vandalism against Kay was obscenities painted on her, the garage of her house, her garage door in red spray paint. But so the law enforcement career was, I guess, the most constant thing in his life. And so when he would get in trouble or start to get in women trouble at an agency, he would just leave and go to another one. And so when we went back to these agencies, and again, this was a different day, you know, that he was in law enforcement, it would have been, you know, in the 1970s. And there was very little documentation in his personnel files, if there even was a personnel file to be found. And so we would go back and interview those, like the retired sheriff and so forth, of one county that he worked for a few years. And they very well remembered the trouble that he got into. But when asked about the lack of documentation in the files, it was more of like, well, young lady, I like to just deal with things face to face and not have all that paperwork. I just like to, you know, man to man. Like, that was an adequate reason for not documenting behavior right. problems in his personnel right. file.
Well, and I've got to guess there's some validity to that, right? Police officers, and I'm not trying to whitewash things, but police officers are under incredible strain. And they
absolutely
every day are putting their life on the line for other people and dealing with some of the worst people on the planet. That has to start to slowly erode people too,
sure.
especially if somebody's already kind of broken. You know, no matter how strong you go into a position like that, at the end of that ride, it's got to have left you hollow at points or you know, segments. I give a lot of credit to law enforcement. You know, anybody that works in those emergency fields that has to deal with death and violence and tragedy on a daily mm-hmm. basis. So sometimes sitting down, talking to somebody, getting it out, dealing with it, and not necessarily making it a part of their permanent record, giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe you just needed somebody to talk to. You needed to vent. You had a bad day, and I don't want to ruin an otherwise long and decent career for that.
Right.
Right. But do you think that he realized that? He played that game? He knew how to manipulate the system then?
I'm sure he did, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate what you said about law enforcement, David. It is very trying, particularly now more than ever.
Right.
But there is a difference between, oh, I bumped up my patrol car and I tried to cover it up, or I was rude to someone that I was dealing with. I shouldn't have lost my cool. You know, they said something about my mama. But Right. That's different.
Right.
That's very different from shoving a woman down on the floor and getting on top of her with a gun between her eyes. That is very different.
Yes, you are correct. But then that does seem way above a step of normalcy. Then it starts to, you can understand to a degree then why people are so upset with police work when stories like this come out, because then you realize that there's this kind of level of complicity almost in some circumstances, like it is the good old boys club.
And it was very different back in the day. And it is not like that now. I mean, now the amount of paperwork and documentation that's required is way over the top. I mean, it's insane. So we're talking about two different time periods, and it is not that way. And I was a police chief the last 10 years of my career, and there were many times when I could recognize a new officer in particularly, or someone who had been there for a while and who was getting burned out and had, you know, was getting careless or was making mistakes, but just needed some guidance or needed to be set on the right track. Totally different from someone that absolutely had no business in the field. And so I'm not sympathetic for, because I know the kinds of behaviors that these agency heads had seen in him. I mean, we're talking some serious violence and this blatant embarrassment and humiliation. I mean, the things he put about one particular lady on the outside of her little white church where all of her church and the community could see it. I mean, there's no excuse for that. It's not that he just,
doing
a good job.
I understand that on his aspect. I was just trying to understand, you know, try to maybe give a little clarity to some of the listeners as to why police chiefs and you know, people in charge may have tried to give a little leniency to somebody in a high pressure stress environment. But you're right, there's absolutely no understanding or logic to what this man did or the methodology he was taking to end his stresses and issues. Alcohol and drugs? Do you know?
He consumed alcohol some, but as far as controlled or illegal substances like cocaine, marijuana, that kind of thing, we never had any indication that he was involved in any of that. But whether he had some issues with prescription medicine, that's certainly a possibility. He was prescribed medicine for back pain, and it was interesting. His back pain seemed to come to go, because even if he wanted to go shag dancing at the dance clubs on the weekend, he seemed to be well able to do that. But if there was something else that he needed to do, work related, then he would use the back injury for an excuse. Now, I'm not saying he didn't have any back pain, but because of that, he was prescribed painkillers. So it's possible that he was under the influence of those. But I can tell you from the time that he was in the jail, he had no substances whatsoever in the jail. And when I talked to him, it was just me and him and this evil presence. And so, you know, that's not a justification or, you know, that wouldn't be an excuse for his personality.
Okay. And again, you know, when you see somebody tipping the scales this far over, it's pretty disturbing. Do you know, going back, I mean, obviously you've written two books and gone in depth into this gentleman, I'm using that term very loosely, but into this man, do you start to see a pattern of irrational behavior going back farther?
Absolutely. Even from his earliest relationships. Well, during the investigation, we didn't have the benefit of talking with his childhood relations first, and then, you know, as he progressed, like we might be interviewing his aunt and uncle from when he was a little fella, and then the same day we're interviewing a woman who had to move out of town just to get away from him. So I tried to present the facts of his background chronologically as best as I could in the book, so that people could see the progression. But as we were conducting the investigation, we might hear some horrible things that he did to a woman, for instance. And then we hear the horrible things that were done to him. And so there's all kinds of correlations, that are popping up. But his behavior and his demeanor got darker and darker as he got older, and as his life, I guess he realized his life didn't turn out the way he intended it to be, and whatever definition of success he had for himself.
It's so tragic. Yeah, it's so tragic to see somebody's life so uncontained like this, but then to realize this is something that had been a part of his life all the time. It has to make it even a little bit more frightening to realize just how sociopathic he was then, that he could continue to move from one person to another, win them over, three marriages, multiple relationships, different law enforcement agencies, and still there wasn't, and people, it's real easy on the outside to sit there and go, oh, they should have, and why didn't they? And because when you see it in bits and pieces, it's not as glaringly obvious. But when you stand back and look at the entire painting from a distance, you can see just what kind of troubled person this was all the way along. And it shows you how people like that come to power or learn to abuse power.
Absolutely. No different than Adolf Hitler. And Underwood also was very charismatic. When he would first meet a woman or even a friend, he was very charismatic. He was the perfect gentleman. It was all about, he's there to protect and to serve. And he really was proud of his badge and his gun, and his house was full of self-serving, different awards he had received, thank you letters. I mean, his entire house and everything on his walls was all about him. There were no pictures of other family members or friends. It was all about him and what he had accomplished or was taking credit for accomplishing.
And then cold-bloodedly murder and kind of walk through it unaffectedly. That is such a strange deal. And then as you're sitting there, right? I mean, you're a detective. Your job is to get to the bottom of this. You feel this even overwhelming sense of just evil, of darkness that manifests from and within this man. There's something there. And obviously we on the outside want to ascribe something like, maybe this guy was possessed. Maybe he was demonic. Maybe he was just so broken that any humanity and soul inside him had died long ago. And they say the eyes are the mirror to the soul. The reason it looked so dark was there was no soul left to shine at all in this human. And that to me really is terrifying in itself. And to know this guy could have, had you guys not pushed, had you not made those jumps, this guy could have continued this reign and done even more damage.
I think definitely you're absolutely right. Kay's son in particular, I think he was next on the list. He resented him. He was jealous over him. And at that time he was only 15, 16 years old. He's still in high school, but, Underwood resented Kay being close to anyone. He did not like her doting on her son. He did not like the teenage attitude, that all teens had. Jason was no problem child by any stretch of the imagination. He was a star athlete, great soccer player. But LC wanted Kay 100% under his control and for him and him alone. And he had already fired a shot into Jason's bedroom. And as in one of those things of divine intervention that I was mentioning, he would very likely have hit Jason in the head had not Jason and Kay rearranged his bedroom that very day without Underwood's knowledge, just, for reorganization storage purposes. They had rearranged his bedroom, and otherwise there was a very good chance that where Underwood shot, he would have struck Jason in the head. And I think he ultimately planned to eliminate Jason from Kay's life.
Good God. So there would have been another body piled up on this. Just to have something for himself. Just to be in complete and utter control. And you're right, boy, if you want to sign a divine intervention, the moving of that room, what was his excuse for having fired off a gun? Was it, it dropped? What happened?
It was anonymous, so to speak. It was during the night. And he had set it up. He had written Kay letters, and he had made anonymous phone calls or had anonymous phone calls made to her saying that Jason was into drugs and he owed money. And so these mysterious drug dealers were going to kill Jason because he was not paying his drug debt. But then later we found out through the investigation that the typed letters that Kay received had been typed on a typewriter in the office of the high school where Elsie Underwood was a school resource officer and had used that typewriter. And in fact, the words on the letter were still on the typewriter ribbon when it was taken from the school.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. You forget about that. The good old days, kids. See, back when we used to have typewriters, there was an ink ribbon and it would spool from one side to another as you typed. The ink was on this ribbon and the keys would strike the paper. I'm sorry that I even have to explain this, but there are a lot of people that won't even realize what we're talking about, and it would leave behind evidence. Boy, that is ingenious. I wouldn't have even thought of that.
Yes, well, it wasn't just a result of the investigators' efforts. The secretary that Elsie asked to borrow the typewriter from, she became suspicious because he was whining and complaining to her repeatedly, "Kay won't call me, my heart is broken, blah, blah, blah," and really just harassing her. And then instead of using the typewriter where his workstation, he asked to borrow the one in her office. And she's just getting more and more suspicious. And she's learning that Kay's house is getting vandalized, she's receiving threatening messages. So she takes it upon herself to take that typewriter ribbon and let us know, or the investigators in Salisbury, and turned it in. So just things like that, you know, that came together out of the blue was very helpful.
Yeah, I would guess so. Wow. Again, just brilliant all the way around that would have even popped up. All right. So you get this guy, he's already doing time. You realize looking back at this other murder that there's these ties to it. How do you end up getting him? And do you end up, are you able to convict on this other murder to the mother?
Okay. So we, with the hair evidence, with the head hair evidence, and that was Victor Gunnarsson's head hair that was ultimately found in the trunk mat of Underwood's car that we got the mitochondrial DNA analysis to confirm for us. So we charge him, we arrest him, and he is convicted for that murder and kidnapping. We are all under the same assumption that next we will charge him with Catherine Miller's murder, and because that evidence was introduced in our case, and the jurors assured us that had they had that jurisdiction, they would also have convicted him of Catherine Miller's murder. So we were very confident that a jury would convict Catherine Miller. But it was the decision of Bill Kinnerly, who was the elected district attorney in Rowan County, because that's where Catherine Miller's murder occurred, in her home. So we just planned, Steve Wilson and I had planned to be, you know, expected to be witnesses in their trial, just like all of them had become witnesses in ours. And Mr. Kennerly had originally planned to go ahead with that. But then after extensive review of the case and some conversations with our prosecutors and others, including the state attorney general, he was concerned that because just because we had physical evidence in our case, the fact that they did not have physical evidence in their case, at least really damning physical evidence, that they might lose that case to a jury. A reasonable doubt might arise, and that might cost him to win an appeal in our case, get a new trial, and get out of prison. So he ultimately made the decision that he was not going to charge Underwood, not going to prosecute him for the murder of Catherine Miller. That is where Raging On, the second book, begins. It begins with the news that we've done all this preparation, everybody's ready to go, we just had a win, we're ready to bring Kay some justice for her mother's murder, and she was really struggling and needing that. All of a sudden, we're done. We're not going to charge him on that. Unless some out of the blue, some new evidence arises that we haven't been able to uncover in the last 4 years, or, you know, or he confessed, which also was not going to happen. And so there, all of a sudden, we're done. But Underwood obviously is not finished. He is raging on in prison. And now I have become his new worst enemy as the lead investigator of the case that got him convicted. And my being a female did not help matters any either. I'm sure assured of that. Now he's focusing on everybody but himself. So he makes threats against Don Gale, the agent in Salisbury that he absolutely hated, against Tom Reuscher, who was our prosecutor in the case, our district attorney, and against me. And in fact, the story picks up with his rage while he's in prison. He has no intentions of staying in prison, but while he's in prison, he is enlisting others to carry out his dastardly deeds, and particularly against me. And at that time, I had a toddler, had a little girl. She was preschool age then, and was married, and he threatened to do what he had attempted to do with his girlfriend, and he wanted to cause an explosion in our house when we were home at night, when the three of us were home, and kill all of them. And he tried to enlist people to help him carry that out. And so Raging On is about his threats against us, what happened in the matters, and ultimately...
But making threats, I mean, obviously the man's behind bars. How...
Sure.
Concerned do you need to be about these threats? Does he have people on the outside willing to do his work?
Well, after 32 years of law enforcement, there's lots of people that are in prison that probably would not mourn, you know, to hear that, you know, we were deceased. But Underwood was more than there was more to him than that. There was more evil in him than the typical offender that's convicted and sentenced. So he was determined, A, to get out. And there were times when he was caught with escape attempt plans and that kind of thing. But he continued to earn his disability retirement benefits while he was in prison. And which ultimately, that's how he left his employment with Salisbury Police Department. Before we arrested him, he retired on this back injury, this medical disability. Police chief was more than happy to help him make that happen, to get rid of him.
Sure.
Peacefully. So he did have a pension, and those benefits that were just growing with interest in his accounts, because he had no living expenses anymore. His house was ultimately sold, so he had that money. He just kept drawing checks and the interest on those checks. So he was stacking up stockpiling a lot of money while he was in prison at the taxpayer's expense. Room and board and educational opportunities, or what else, you know, whatever else we paid for while he was in prison. So he did have financial means, and that you know, all it takes. So the way that some of those plans were intercepted was because of his communications with other inmates contracting them. One in particular who was, he was getting out, whose sentence was almost up. He had agreed to pay $25,000, I believe, for him to carry out these threats that he had made against me and my family and against the prosecutor. So you can make things happen just because he's behind bars and he's got nothing else but time on his hand to plan these things and to communicate with these other inmates and make things happen. So it wasn't just an unrealistic threat. But the more detailed the more details we learned about it and the more detailed he became in his planning, then we began to, you know, get really concerned. And there were moments, there would be strange vehicles, you know, follow me and ride on my tail. And obviously, you know, trying to intimidate me. There was evidence of people around my house, and I lived out in the county in a rural area. You know, so there were times when I felt like I was just as afraid of Kay as Kay was, you know, afraid. But, you know, you learn to deal with those things and you go on, you have a job to do and a family to take care of, and you can't let yourself get consumed with those fears. But they were more than just the typical threats that, you know, we get from someone that, you know, that's convicted of a crime.
This was worthy of concern. This was worthy of real fear because of what this guy was. And as you said, kind of what he put out, terrifying stuff. You move forward in this, knowing that he's kind of got these tendrils out there. And as you said, you can't live in a place of fear. You have to do what it takes to get to the bottom of these situations, to answer these questions and make sure that justice is meted out. Now, what is, you know, you're obviously kind of running up against some barriers. You're running up against, you know, threats. You're running up against all of this. What is your worst kind of enemy during all this? Is it just time? Is it, you know, what exactly is your biggest concern?
As far as Underwood?
And the entire case, yeah.
Well, on one level, it was that he would get before a rogue judge that would not carefully review the evidence and the trial, and that he would get his conviction overturned. Because now all of a sudden I'm his arch enemy number one, and if he gets out, his focus is going to be, you know, directed towards me. So that was an issue. We felt really good about the case. There was one decision from a judge that was known for granting new trials to homicide offenders. And we thought that was going to happen. And he had made that decision, but then it very quickly got overturned before Underwood was ever released from prison. So there was a few moments that we were, you know, our pucker factor was up just a little bit. But ultimately we were confident in the job that we had done. And
I like that. The pucker factor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's gotta be terrifying in itself. You've got a judge who is, not always, I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but is not really a fan of justice, it seems.
He had a reputation for making just really off-the-wall decisions. And Underwood got one of his appeals in front of him. And so, yeah, there were a few days there that we were on pins and needles. But ultimately, he lost all of his appeals. But he was continuing to appeal up until right before I retired and what happened with the case. And I don't want to have a spoiler, but that is the climax and the finality of what happened with Raging On. And so I don't want to give a spoiler alert, but something did happen to change things. But also I want to mention that he develops one more relationship with a woman while he was in custody.
No.
And just because a person is locked up, you know, does not mean they're not still engaged in the in society. But he developed a relationship with a woman that he actually met in the jail in Watauga County when we first arrested him. And they continued to communicate and develop a relationship. And that relationship is a big part of Raging On, the sequel, because this time he met his match. He met someone who was, for lack of a better word, as messed up as he was, who had made some mistakes, who was engaged in criminal behavior, and who was as able in the realm of conning,
manipulation, and conning. Yeah, wow.
That he was. And so some interesting things happened out of his relationship with her. And that's that story is also in Raging On.
Excellent. Now, before any of you write to me and, what's this? She's just trying to sell a book. Yeah, that's what they're all doing when they come here, folks. We get a lot of the meat from these stories, a lot of the intricacies, and there's still some that you need to read about. And what we've talked about is still a glossary look at the totality of this very twisted case spread out over two books. We have a link for those books on today's program guide, so make sure you check that out and review it for yourself. Detective May, thank you for, first of all, serving and doing what you could to maintain law and order. And I personally appreciate that. I know Tim does. We are firm advocates for law enforcement, and we know that a few bad apples does not spoil the entire barrel. But thank you for your tenacity and work in this field to make sure that the real bad guys get put away.
Well, I appreciate that. And I will say, just in response to the comments about the book, I never perceived myself to be an author, but this was a case that had to be told. It begged being written down and documented. It was just, there's just so many plot twists and turns and so many things happen that I just felt compelled to tell that story. I may not ever write another book about another case, but this one had to be written and had to be told. So first and foremost, I'm a cop. I'm an investigator, and that's where my allegiance is. Mm-hmm. But I just felt that I didn't have any other choice but to write this book, and I'm grateful to Wild Blue Press for them taking a chance on me and becoming interested in the story.
Well, I hope that you do continue to write, because you're talented at it. You have a great way of telling the story. And please, folks, when you pick up the books, make sure that you rate and review them on whatever site that you've purchased them from, so that way they do get seen and more people are exposed to it. We wish you a lot of luck and continued success with these books and telling the truth about these cases. So thank you very much, Detective May. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Dave, for what you do and for all of your listeners and followers.
Thank you. All right, folks. A twisted, sordid tale, to say the least. We have a link up for Raging On and the first book, First Degree Rage, the true story of the assassin and obsession and murder, so you can read the entire story. So go check it out. It's on today's program guide. You can also go to darknessradio.com, click on the shop tab. You'll see our Amazon shop there. Click. We've got true crime category. We've got our paranormal category. We've got gift category and more. So there's a lot of great things, but all the books that you hear featured on the show appear on those pages. We hope you enjoyed today's program of True Crime Tuesday. And remember, if you'd like the full episode with the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals aspect, all you have to do is go over and subscribe now for Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, to get some deep discount savings for your 1 year subscription. And it will give you access to all of our archives from Darkness Radio. There's over 1,000 episodes up and available, and more being added constantly. You get all of the episodes of True Crime Tuesday, and you get all of the other great programs that are part of Stitcher. Hundreds of thousands of hours of programming for $5 a month, commercial free. You can't beat that, so don't even try. Go subscribe now, and remember to use keyword Darkness Radio for those key savings.